Just a small point. When I was talking about that lady who was selling my holy water last night, please don't think that because I touched this water, you can take this away and flog it online. Holy water. Okay. For this morning's Dhamma talk, again, keeping it on the practice of meditation and how to make it deeper, how to overcome the problems of meditation, because I know that sometimes you can say all about what enlightenment is and the meaning of life, the nature of existence, which is always good fun, but you know, sometimes coming back to the what we usually call the real world, of actually sitting here dealing with the difficulties and problems of life and how to overcome them and how to find some peace and freedom from the difficulties in life. I think that's more important here, and what actually you discover at the end of the path. And that's one of the reasons why I told that little story, you know, about all the simile of the lotus and what's in the right in the middle of it. Now that's the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And I never told you what it was, because you have to find that out for yourself. And it just reminds me of an old story, just to get me going, and just to make sure that these talks in the morning are always interesting for each one of you. And this was a story of a gentleman, Australian man, who was trekking in the Himalaya mountains in the province of Ladakh, which was known as to the west of Tibet, the east of Kashmir. And he was up there in the mountains trekking, and you know, he was not really following the guides, the tour guide's instructions. He was lingering around, taking a photograph of this, exploring a little bypath. But then, you know, he went a little bit too far off track, and he got himself lost. And he was actually looking for the rest of the group and couldn't find them. And as he, you know, was trying to look for them, he got more and more lost. And you know, it was getting late. It was getting cold, and you know, it's wilderness areas, a long way from anywhere, and he started getting quite concerned as the sun started to go down, as it started going to twilight, because you know there are bears in that mountains, there are leopards, there's all sorts of dangerous animals there, and it'll be very cold as well at night time, and so he was really getting concerned. But he saw in the distance some lights, you know, obviously electric lights. So he followed the direction for those lights, and he found it was a monastery in the middle of Himalayas, a Buddhist monastery. And the monasteries, you know, in those remote areas, they always allow people to come and stay if they, you know, need a place to rest for the night. And when the abbot found out it was a Westerner who got lost, you know, in the walking around, and just as a byproduct there, that sometimes and many times people have not followed the instructions here and gone walking all over the place. And there have been two or three times now, our nearest neighbour on top of the hill, and that's the Tiger Meditation Centre, they ring us up and say, we found another couple of your people getting lost. And they ring us up, they come and bring them over here anyway. You're not too far lost, but, you know, be careful. So anyway, they was given some accommodation for the night, and you know, because there was a Westerner, just the abbot, and gave him his own little room, because that's the only place with a nice bed. And so the Australians slept in the bed, and the night really exhausted, happy to get a place to sleep tonight, and a bit of soup or something for his tummy. But then in the middle of the night, he woke up. You know, in the bed, in the abbot's room, there's this amazing music. And he's wondering where it was coming from, because there's no radio or iPods or anything like that, and it was just... It was not just that he couldn't find out where it was coming from, but it was just the most amazing, beautiful music he'd ever heard in his life. You know, he'd been to Sydney Opera House, he'd seen, you know, the great performers, you know, do all sorts of classical music and rock music and jazz, but this exceeded everything he'd ever heard. It was just thrilling. And it was just so soothing as well that he fell asleep, and when next thing he knew, he woke up in the morning really refreshed. And so, after getting some breakfast and saying thank you to the abbot sort of knew where the tour group would be staying, so he got a monk to take him there so they could catch up with the others. But the Australian said to him, he said, look, middle of the night, I woke up and heard this amazing, beautiful noise, or music, can't really call it a noise. What was it? And the other looked up, oh, you know, you heard that too. You're very fortunate. Yeah, but what was it? And the abbot said, look, I'm terribly sorry, but, you know, that I can't tell you. You have to be a monk to know what that sound is. And he said, oh, come on. He said, no, look, you know, that's our rules. You know, only monks can know the secret of that incredible music, and it's supernatural. And so he signed and got out his wallet and said, okay, how much? $100, $200? He said, no, look, I'm not that type of monk. Don't care what you give. I will not accept money. This is something very profound. Only a monk can understand, you know, what that music is. And it doesn't matter how much money this Australian offered, how much he pleaded and haggled, no. So, you know, he had to go off, you know, to reach his group. When he came back to Sydney, that he was haunted by that music. It was something which looked like he'd never heard before. And he couldn't get it out of his head. So, you know, it was really affecting his social life, his work life. So he went to see the GP, got referred to a psychologist and a psychiatrist. They gave him all sorts of medication and therapy, but nothing worked. And so, 1 year later, he was back in that monastery, you know, knocking on the abbot's door and said, look, you know, I've been going crazy trying to figure out what that music is. You had to let me know. And the abbot said, look, I told you, sir, that, you know, I can't let anyone know. You have to be a monk for that. Doesn't matter how much money you bring me. No. He said, you understand that, said the Australian, but I've got to find out what that sound is. So, ordain me as a monk. And he said, well, it takes a couple of years of training. He said, I don't care. I'd go crazy if I don't find out what that heavenly music was. Okay, said the monk. So he entered the 2-year training to become a fully ordained monk, just because he had to find out the origin of that most supernatural music. So, after 2 years, came his ordination day. Shaved off his hair, did the ceremony, wore the robes, and as soon as he was pronounced a fully ordained monk, now, tell me what that music is. 3 years I've been waiting. And so the abbot said, look, instead of just telling you, now I'll show you, so you can have direct experience yourself. So meet me in my office just before midnight. So about 11 o'clock, you know, this, he was so excited. He was waiting outside until 5 to midnight, and then the abbot let him in. And there was this curtain on the back of the office there, of the bedroom, sorry, and he thought it was just a cupboard, but no, he opened up the curtain and there was this really old wooden door. You know, like a thing you'd see in ancient buildings maybe 1,000 years ago. And he got out from his desk a set of keys. And he got out the first key. He said, you really want to hear this and see this? He said, yep. This is why I became a monk. Okay. So he got out the big wooden key and he just opened up the lock. And it was really, really rusty. Not many people go in there. And so he opened up the lock, and inside there was just like a corridor, very dark. And just as he started going into that corridor with the abbot, he could hear the music again. First time he heard it in 3 years. And my goodness, it was just thrilling. All his tiredness, all his waiting was worth it just to hear that music. I mean, it's way, way better than any Mozart or Brahms or anything. It was incredible stuff. And so when they walked down this long corridor, there was another door at the end, a very solid iron door, again, ancient. And so the abbot took out an iron key, and he opened up the iron door, which was also really rusty, really creaked. And then, of course, getting closer to the music, the source of this supernatural sound, he could hear it so much more clearly. Tears were coming down his cheeks. It was incredible. And he noticed at the end of that corridor there was another door, but this was solid silver. You know, dug out of the mountains, I don't know how long ago, and it was just, be worth a lot of money. And so the abbot took out the silver key, opened the door, and the music now was just really clear. And it was just thrilling. He was shaking with excitement and with joy and with bliss. Just, this was something really out of the world, like he'd never heard before. And as they went down the last section of corridor, it was a golden door at the very end. And it was encrusted with priceless jewels. You know, even in the palaces of sultans or monarchs, you would never see anything like that. It was worth a fortune, just the door itself. And just the other side, he knew that that was the source of the most amazing music he'd ever heard. And the abbot paused and looked at the Australian and said, "Look, this is something which is, you know, really supernatural, out of this world. You know, sometimes it's too much for people. And that's why we always say it's only for monks to know that. So, are you sure you want me to open this door? Because this will change your whole life." And he thought for a while, because the abbot, he wasn't just playing games. This was serious stuff. You know, it could drive him crazy. But he said, "Well, look, if I don't hear this sound, I've come quite close. I'll go crazy anyway. I've got nothing to lose. Open it." So the abbot put the golden key into that lock and turned it. And he slowly opened the door. And the Australian, the new monk's eyes went wide. He was shaking. He couldn't believe what he saw, what the source of that sound was. You know what it was? "I'm sorry, I can't tell you. You're not monks." I know that's really mean and nasty. But I love telling that story. I've got a sadistic streak in me. So much for compassion. I told that story. The first time I told it, I think it was in KL, and the audience said they howled with laughter. They pleaded, "Please let me know." But anyway, so the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know, if I told you that, would you understand? You've got to be a nun or a monk to understand that. So off you go. Anyway, that's why, instead of telling people just the meaning of life, you just get you in there until you can open up the door and find out for yourself. So that's why in these talks, instead of arguing about, you know, stuff and your truth, my truth, somebody else's truth, you know, how you can find it out for yourself, which is great. Now, the problem, you know, with finding out things, you know, for yourself, with getting deep meditation, getting stillness and opening the door of your heart and seeing what's really going on, it's very clear what you need to do. It's so obvious. If you want stillness, just put it down. Let it go. And, you know, you understand what to do, but why can't you do it? What is the problem? Why is it that you've got all the, you know, wonderful support here, nice rooms, good food, you know, just comfort, you've got no impingements, no distractions, everything is there. And you think, "Wow, if I can't do it here, where can I do it?" So obviously it's not the place, it's something else which is the problem. And this is what the Buddha called the five hindrances, the obstacles, the barriers which stop a person getting into deep meditation and which distort your perceptions and views and thoughts. This is the enemy, if you want to call anything an enemy, the five hindrances. And those five hindrances are wanting, its opposite, which is aversion, not wanting something, and it is sloth and torpor, the dullness of the mind, the restlessness and remorse, guilt, in other words. That's a hindrance in Buddhism. It's great to see that. Wow, you mean I'm not supposed to feel guilty? No. Isn't that a bit sort of a slippery slope to doing whatever you want and having no shame about, you know, being keeping noodles in your hut. And the answer is, you're not supposed to have shame because we trust people and it's really up to you. This is the nice little understanding about one of the biggest obstacles to people is that remorse and shame. Okay, I'll just go a bit further then, and the other one was doubt. I did mention a lot about doubt on that first talk about the going through the mist in the mountains. But just going back to remorse, you know that sometimes we think, well, what we did, why we did it, and we think, oh, you know, we got away with it. And one of the great stories which I read, it was actually from a Hindu book tradition. And in this book, it was a long time ago, when in many places that one teacher, you know, would have a lot of students and would teach them everything. You know, it's like the word is polymath, means you don't know, you know many, many things. And so a teacher would, you know, teach you the languages and even argument and debate and mathematics and astronomy and so science and business, whatever. One teacher would teach a whole group of people. And so this teacher had a lot of students. Okay, now this was a long time ago, okay? So these days you think, oh, you can't get away with this sort of sexist, misogynist stuff in these days. But in those days, he had a daughter, and it was a tradition that he had to marry his daughter to one of his students. I don't know if the daughter had much say in that, but you know, those were ancient days. But that's, you know, not real an essential part of the story. But she was such a beautiful girl, and all the students would really think it was Christmas Day. It all got together, you know, if they managed to get chosen to marry this very charming, beautiful girl. So one day, the teacher got all the students together and said, students, you know our tradition. You know, you have to, my daughter has to marry one of you. Me. And they said, look, I have a problem. The first problem is I don't know which one of you to choose. You're always all very good and very kind and very wise. I'm sure you make a great husband to my daughter. And she, you know, likes all of you. But I've got to choose between you, and that's very difficult. At the same time, you know, I'm extremely poor. And, you know, to get married, you know, you need a good celebration. And you need to get set up in a house and all the furnitures and stuff. You know, just to get set up. And I've got no money for that. So he said, you know, the test is, I'm going to give you all a test. And it's an obedience and also of innovation, showing initiative, being a good person, and following instructions. So he said, for the next 2 weeks, I want you to go into the village, the towns close by, actually just a few villages outside, and I want you to creep into the people's houses in the middle of the night or whenever they're away and steal whatever you can. Just make sure that no one sees you. And when you come back, you know, all of what you're stolen, I keep a good record of it, the one who takes the most will marry my daughter. And all that stuff will be used, you know, to set yourselves up as a man and wife, get a good start in life. And all the students were really shocked. Are you asking us to steal? You know, you're a really good person. But he said, well, you know, that's the only thing we can do. So just follow the instructions. So, out of obedience to their teacher, they snuck into the village late at night. They stole this, they stole that, making sure that no one saw them. And they came back. They came back to the teacher, and he took a really accurate record who stole what from where and when. And after, even before 2 weeks, after about 10 days, he said, that's enough. You've all taken so much, we don't need to take any more. There's so much stuff here that will make any couple very, very well supplied for in the first years of their marriage. and they're all waiting to see who stole the most and would marry the daughter. But he said, except one of you. One of you has been so bad, you haven't stolen anything at all. Explain your disobedience. And this shy young man came up and said, I wasn't disobedient, Master. I followed your instructions. Well, why didn't you steal anything? Well, I crept into the village late at night. I waited for the people to be asleep or gone out. And I crept into their houses and I saw really expensive things laying around. And I was about to put my hand on them and I realized someone was watching. Who? Said the teacher. Me, said the student. I was watching me steal. That's why I couldn't take anything. Sadhu, 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 said the teacher. At least I've got one smart disciple who follows instructions. I told you, make sure that no one sees you stealing. And you're so stupid, you thought somebody else. But no, you see yourself breaking precepts. That is the whole meaning of this little exercise. And he said to the other stupid students, now you can take all that stuff back. The people in the houses, they won't punish you or shake you to the pieces. This was a setup. I told the people in the villages a couple of weeks ago you were coming. It was a test for you. And only one student passed it. He said, I've got plenty of money. I just want to find out, you know, what sort of character is suitable to marry my daughter. Someone who won't break precepts. Even when you're my daughter, you know, when she's married to you, even though, you know, she may not see what you're up to. You see what you're up to. So therefore you'd never break your precepts. So this smart young guy married the daughter. And of course they lived happily ever after. I read that in a cartoon book of Hindu tales. And it had a sort of a meaning that, you know, whatever you do, you see you doing it. You can't hide things from yourself. So because of that, no remorse, you see yourself doing things, so what do? You don't feel guilty, because if you feel guilty, you feel diminished, you're not good enough, you're a terrible person. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, trust me, Bianca cooks such delicious food, and I just sneak some back afterwards. Oh, this is terrible. What do I do this for? Now that just stops you having any happiness at all. We don't do remorse, punishment or guilt. Because if we did, then you'd be hiding things all the time. Hiding things from yourself, hiding things for others. And that hiding, covering things up, that is just so spiritually just a cancer. So you make a mistake. In Bodhidharma Monastery, that's one of the things I keep telling the monks and the nuns to. You're allowed to make mistakes. You're permitted to make mistakes. So if you make a mistake, great. I tell other people about my mistakes. So they can feel that they are human. I had to learn that myself. Many of you have been over to Bodhidharma Monastery. Once, you know, I'd just taken over being the abbot, being the boss of this place. And then, about, you know, 6 months being an abbot, I was walking through the grounds and I saw that somebody had left a hammer out in the grass. And it was getting rusty. And I looked at that and I thought, everything we get as monks, and same as nuns, is all donations. Or like people who actually, you know, give some money so we can buy something. Or give a hammer, you know, so we can do some building. Everything, you know, we don't buy from our own resources. It's all donated. There are some people who are really wealthy and they donate. But there's some people who are just so poor. But still they want to give something because they really appreciate what we're doing here. And I don't know, maybe some poor person had saved up for weeks, months, to buy a hammer and give it to the monastery so it could help us with the building work. And some careless, heedless, you know, insensitive monk had left it out there instead of putting it away to get rusty. And so, you know, because I was just starting off being an abbot, I called a meeting to all the monks and novices and agaricas at the time. And it wasn't just, you know, the usual adjunct problem, lots of smiling and jokes. I really blasted them about the importance of generosity, and we should not waste people's gifts. You don't know where that may have come from. People may have just sacrificed so much to get that hammer for you, and you leave it out there getting rusty. That's just not on. That's not acceptable. You know, we have to look after people's donations. We can't just abuse them like this. This is not good, not right. And I went on like this for a while. And at the end of the sort of the little telling off, all the monks that were sitting, no one's actually sleeping. When I tell jokes, they just sleep and nod and stuff like that. But they were all sitting perfectly upset. And then I waited for a pause for a while, find out, you know, who did it. I'd expected that one of the monks would put their hand up and say, look, I'm terribly sorry, I was busy, or I forgot, it was me. But not one monk put their hand up to confess. And that hurt me more than anything else, that they wouldn't actually confess they made a mistake. And I really thought that maybe I'd gone too far, you know, just, you know, scolding them too much, you know, told them off, and so they're too scared to admit it was, you know, it must have been somebody. And so I was really disappointed. You know, sometimes, you know, you're just, come on, you know, a spiritual life, we're supposed to be honest and not have so much ego and stuff. You know, you make a mistake, just admit it for goodness sake. Maybe I've gone a bit too far, and people too scared to admit their mistakes. So I went outside really disappointed. And when I went outside the, you know, the entrance of the hall, just as I got outside the second door, you know, it was a flash of insight. I remembered who left that hammer on the outside. You know who it was me. I remembered. But why can't I remember before I scold and blame others? Only afterwards. Stupid mind. absolutely true. This is no exaggeration. I had to turn around and say, could you just sit down for a few more moments? I finally found out who left the hammer, that it was me. I'm sorry, Mark, scolding you for that. Has that ever happened to you? It happened to me a couple of times. When I make a mistake, I think it's somebody else's fault, and then somebody reminds me it was my fault. So that taught me some nice lessons that, you know, why have remorse? You make mistakes. So if you make a mistake, what do you do about it? How can we make sure the mistakes get less and less and less and less and less? Have you noticed mistakes get more and more and more sometimes? Why is that? Because people are so afraid, they're so tense of making mistakes. I can't make a mistake. If Ajahn Brahm finds out, he won't let me come on a retreat ever again. I'll be blacklisted. So sometimes we're so afraid of making mistakes, we're so tense, we make more mistakes. That's when I was riding a bicycle for the first time, about 9, 10, 11 years of age, I forget what. You know, I was so afraid of falling off. I remember I was so stiff, I was holding onto those handlebars until my knuckles went white. And I kept on falling off. Because I was afraid of falling off. I was so scared, I was so tight, so tense in the body. You know, you didn't actually go with a bicycle when you went around corners. So then later on, you know, forgot about falling off, you know, messing around, having fun with your friends, and then you didn't fall off anymore. You relaxed, you know, the body swayed with the bike. Always remember that, just what you're afraid of usually make happen. If you're afraid of making mistakes, you're going to make another mistake. So instead, what do we do? Instead of having remorse, we can't be just, oh, I've done nothing wrong. No, we learn from mistakes, because mistakes sort of hurt us, hurt other people, and let ourselves down. So we learn from them to make sure we don't make the same mistake again. So when I was a school teacher, I developed the 70% rule. Because I gave a examination in math for the very first time, I didn't know what to do. I knew I had to do maths, but actually, how do you set exams? Tests. So I went to a senior teacher and he said, don't do it too hard. If it's too difficult, And people only get, you know, sort of 5% or 10% or 20%. They will all come out thinking that maths is too hard, too difficult. They will start to believe they can't do maths if they get a low score. But if they get too high a score, everyone gets 98, 99%. It's a waste of time. It's too easy. So the senior maths teacher said, try and aim for 70%. Because 70% is a good score. You know, the people who do a maths test get 70%. Oh, yeah, I can do maths. And the most important part is the 30% where they don't get it right. Because that gives the teacher, me, feedback. You know, what they didn't understand. I thought they'd understood that part of maths, but they didn't understand it. So it gives me the feedback so the next lessons I can address the weaknesses. So, you know, making mistakes is the feedback time. So that's why I aim for 70%. And I realized that was the same for life. If you always get it right, if you always score 100%, you don't learn anything. You don't grow and mature. If you're always making 10%, 20%, then you get depressed. I can't do anything right. So, but 70% is the best. You know, you're encouraged, but you learn. So, building on that, if you've got, like, say, a husband or a partner who's only 70%, they're perfect. If they're 80, 90%, you learn nothing, so dump them. I think that's why my girlfriend dumped me. This is where we learn and grow. So anyway, making mistakes is the growing area of life. So we don't hide them. We open them up and let people know about them. We don't feel remorse. We say, this is part of life. We're growing. Great. Marvelous. But because of our culture, people always feel guilty about mistakes. So this brings us to the story of the young man who was training to become a monk. He was the Anagarika, the people in white, you see, and they're staying in a monastery. And so this Anagarika, he came to see me early one morning, and he said, I haven't slept all night. So what happened? Too much coffee? He said, no, too much guilt. So what happened? He said, oh, you know, yesterday afternoon, I was hungry, and I went into the kitchen at Bodhinyana Monastery. There was no one there. I looked around, no one to be seen. So I made myself a sandwich. And worse, I ate it. I was hungry. So sorry. I want to be a monk. Please don't kick me out. And this poor young man, he really didn't have much idea of what Buddhism was. He'd never been to see a real monastery before. And so I told him, I said, look, it's okay, wonderful. You made a mistake. You were hungry in the afternoon. So, first of all, eat more at lunchtime. You know, stuff yourself up a bit more, you know, for some energy for the afternoon. And I listed all the things you can eat in the afternoon. And some of the people asked me, why do you eat this and why can't you eat that? Just don't argue, just eat it. You know, chocolate, and over here you can have milk and cheese and orange juice and apple juice and carrot juice, and goodness knows what you can eat over here. Sometimes you can eat a whole meal. Seems a bit, but you know, not really quite. And you know that that people know all about, you know, what's allowable, what's not. So I said, you know, eat more. You can have like honey, if you want some honey, just to get some energy going inside of you. You know, there's so much you can eat. So have some of that in the afternoon, if you feel hungry. But, you know, don't need to sort of go and make a sandwich. And I said, okay, now you can go now, okay? And he stopped and said, Ajahn Brahm, aren't you going to punish me for breaking the rules? I said, no, you learn from them, you know, just do things differently next time. And he said, you have to punish me, he said. Because if you don't punish me, if you don't give me some sort of penance, I know my character, I'll do it again. Because that's how people learn, you know, in places like Australia. You make a mistake, you've got to get fined, punished, or sent to your room, or something, you know, to actually emphasize the fact you made a mistake. And I said, no, you don't do that. He said, you have to punish me. So he put me on the spot. So I devised this Buddhist punishment for him. And the case was, just fresh in my mind, I'd been reading a history book about Australia when the first convicts came to Australia. And if they did anything wrong, they got brutally, viciously whipped, you know, with a thing called the cat of nine tails. And I'd just been reading that maybe an hour or two before. It was, you know, fresh in my mind. So I told this young man, okay, if you want a punishment, I'll give you a traditional Australian punishment, because this is where we are. So I'll sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat. And you should have seen this man's face. I wish I had that on YouTube. Absolute fear, all the colour draining from his face, his lips quivering. You know, he really thought that I was going to whip him. That's how little he knew about Buddhism. And then I said, sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat, which in this monastery means this. At that time we had, I think, two cats. Find one of them, hold it in your lap and stroke it. One stroke of the cat, two strokes of the cat, three strokes, four. Learn some compassion, you hard-hearted young man. So that was the sentence, 50 strokes of the cat for making a mistake. If you can't find a cat, find a teddy bear. So 50 strokes of the teddy bear. Okay, got up late this morning. One, two, three. So that's where you learn the softness and the kindness. That's a Buddhist punishment. 50 strokes of a rabbit, cat, I don't know, something or other. Not the snake. He doesn't like being stroked. So this is how we overcome remorse. We learn, we're kind. We have that compassion, we grow. And then we don't have the remorse. We feel that we are good enough. That we can do it. There's nothing wrong with us. You think, oh, these other people, yeah, they're so pure-hearted, they're so good. Yeah, they can get jaded, they're not me. Oh, if everybody knew what I got up to, what I was thinking when I was meditating. If they knew how I was planning to assassinate Ajahn Brahm, if he tells that joke once more. So we have all this guilt inside of us, which, you know, the only way to overcome that is just compassion, finding a teddy bear and stroking it. Forgiveness, letting go. That's why, you know, because it's Australia, AFL code. It's not Australian Football League, it's acknowledge mistakes, forgive them, which means no punishment, and learn from them. You know, it's much easier to acknowledge when there's no punishment. You're not afraid of admitting, oh, I made a mistake. Say, Meg, made a mistake, oh yeah, and then other people can help you do it better next time, which means that you learn. And that's called growth. That was one of the really impressive teachings when I first came across Buddhism. He said, no, we don't do punishment or guilt in Buddhism. Wow. I mean, I don't have to feel bad about what I've done. No. Everyone makes mistakes. We acknowledge it, so we don't suppress it and hide it. Oh, I didn't do that. No, not me. But we acknowledge it, and we forgive it. Forgiveness, amnesty, encourages acknowledgement. And then once we've acknowledged it, not sort of try and deny it out of fear, out of guilt, out of fear of punishment, then we actually learn from it. We realize it's okay to make mistakes, and that is where people grow. So that's why, in Bunyan and Manchu, when you allow people to make mistakes, they make less mistakes. And they learn much better. Instead of always thinking, oh, you have to be perfect. If you try to be perfect out of fear, you never become perfect. But if you just let go, no sort of fear, then perfection comes. Have you ever seen that t-shirt? Which says, nobody's perfect. First line. Second line, I'm a nobody. No, non-self. Third line, therefore I must be perfect. That's how to become perfect. No one's perfect. You're a nobody. Therefore you're perfect. That's logic. So, when you stop trying, then you become perfect. You just be like the trees in the forest again. So, that's one of those hindrances, remorse, which is tied to the restlessness, because when we think we're not good enough, we're always on the run, running away from ourselves, like hiding, just like a person who's broken the law is always on the run, you know, because they're afraid of being caught and being punished. So don't do that. But the major part of restlessness and its opposite, sloth and torpor, the dullness and the restlessness, and you've heard me say that before, I think on one of the first talks, that when I was in Thailand, always sleepy, and then I was fighting that, and then you broke through and you were restless, and then you were sleepy again, always both ends of the pendulum, but never in the middle, this beautiful place where you're not restless, the mind is not just jumping all over the place, but you're really alert. How do you get to that place? And that took me such a long time to figure out. Willpower was not the way. Because what I did, here this will do, that I decided to try and use willpower. Because you know, sometimes that I thought I broke through and I wasn't sleepy, but people told me you were sleepy, because when you're sleepy, you're dull. You don't realize you're sleepy. Already people have asked me, I was very peaceful, but how do I know I was not asleep? You know, and what you can do, what I did, I got a matchbox, took off the cover, so just the tray with the matches inside, and put it on my head. Because when I started getting sleepy, my head would droop, it would fall off. So I'd get like feedback. So I knew, you know, when I was sleeping, when I was actually being alert. And only took a few days, and I could keep that matchbox on my head for the morning meditations, and it never fell off at all. One whole hour, I thought I'd beaten my sleepiness. And then one of the monks, come over here, Ajahn Brahm, I've been watching you. And he said, I can tell you why that matchbox doesn't fall off anymore. You're still sleepy, but you're going like this. The mind is just so tricky sometimes. That was the truth of the matter. So it just was so just, and of course in the end I just gave up. Yay, at last, what did I do to start with? Giving up. Because why are you sleepy? It's cause and effect. It's not you, not a self. It's not a bad thing. You don't feel remorse about it. It's causes. So sometimes you may not have slept well last night. Or, you know, you may be getting sick. Or it may be too hot. Or there's so many reasons why people can get sleepy. And so it's just causes, that's all. Nothing to do with you. Don't take it as a personal failure if you're sleepy. That's why I say, you know, any time, if you really feel sleepy, just go to bed. That's what they're there for. Ananda method of enlightenment. It worked for him, you know, give it a go. Didn't work first time, try again. But especially that when you are fighting, this was the point which I've mentioned many times, I'm really going to emphasize now, when you're fighting, you know, trying to argue with yourself, trying to force yourself, what happens is that you waste energy. The human mind, you can describe it in many ways, and a useful way of describing it is two parts to the human mind. Basically, if anyone knows the khandhas, it's like the will, the sankhara, and the other three khandhas, you know, consciousness, perception, and experience. So, will, and I call that the doer, and the consciousness, mindfulness, perception, experience, I call that the knower. The knower and the doer. Just making that sort of duality there. For the sake of understanding. So, I notice that your mind, most of it is consumed by doing something. Thinking, planning, assessing, complaining, writing your own biography, fantasizing, whatever. And, you know, this is what we do. And that creates so much of an energy sink. You just lose energy, it pours out through doing stuff. But when you stop doing things, you stop planning, you stop lingering in the past, you stop thinking, you stop talking to yourself, you stop giving yourself a commentary. When you are still, you stop doing stuff. All that energy which should have gone into doing, into activity, into reacting to stuff, that energy is now freed to go into the knowing. So you've got a certain amount of energy, it usually gets wasted basically in thinking and doing and planning and complaining and wanting and whatever. Instead of it getting wasted there, when you stop doing stuff, you relax, let go, let things be. All that energy just goes into the knowing. So the knowing gets energized. And this is where people, they start becoming awake. You start to feel the body. You start to hear the different intonations of the speech. You start to smell the air. You start to see the beautiful flowers outside, and there's so much color in just one leaf. You look at the sunset, and you never see the sunset like that before. It blows your mind. There's just so many amazing colors. The sound of the birds is fantastic. It's not just one sound. There's just so many like different instruments there, as it were, in just one little bird sound. And you go on your walking meditation, you can feel incredible sensations in your legs and your feet as you walk. It's like alive. You're becoming, knowing is becoming enhanced. I don't know why other people don't talk about this. It's in the suttas. It's called, I call it power mindfulness. Now we've got the mindfulness movement, just be mindful. Yeah, but what about what happens when the mindfulness really takes off and becomes very, very strong? And I mentioned it briefly that sometimes when you're meditating, you feel the body like the ants crawling all over you, just really feel alive, so sensitive. You know, the wind is just so sensuous as it just blows past you. Wow, that's incredible. That's actually your senses becoming really empowered when you stop being restless. Because you don't waste your energy. And of course, sloth and torpor has no chance. Just like the mist in the early morning when the sun comes up, the sun burns off the mist and so it becomes really clear and bright. That's what happens with letting go, letting things be, and the energy going into mindfulness. Well, that's why you do feel really energized sometimes. That's why sometimes you can't go to sleep. Because you're too powered up, energized. Not in a restless way, but in just beautiful, poised way. That's called waking up. Which, to understand what enlightenment is, the word Buddha, it comes from a Pali Sanskrit word called Bujati, which means to wake up, literally, in the morning. Open your eyes, get up. You're awake. But waking up is not just normal people's waking up, they're half asleep. Sometimes when you first wake up and you bang things and where am I? But this is where it's super power mindfulness. You really are fully awake to the point that you can see, you can smell like you've never been able to smell before, like everything is amplified. And beautifully so, which is why these states are always accompanied by incredible joy and happiness. So, because the mindfulness is going in, so the energy is going into mindfulness, you wake up. And because it's becoming so joyful, it's the natural part of mindfulness. If it's stronger the mindfulness, the stronger the joy, the stronger the energy. Just an ordinary simile. If you, when you wake up in the morning, you're a pain in the neck to your partner and to yourself until you've had your first cup of coffee. When you had your first cup of coffee, your boost of vitamin C, vitamin caffeine, sometimes, and then you're happy. Why is that? You know, it's just because energy in the mind often causes like happiness. You feel good, you feel energized. That's why people have these energy drinks sometimes, and especially the kids, so they're just like, you know, happy and high, and but you know, that's just a bit of a plastic happiness, a plastic energy. But the real stuff which gets, you know, from being really still and getting that energy coming up into the mindfulness, that is really cool. And of course, when you're happy, you don't want anything. I already mentioned to you, like being a monk, sometimes, everyone, what do you want? Nothing. But can we get you something? Nothing. But I want to make some merit. Nothing. Isn't it wonderful that you're so content you don't want anything? Have you ever been like that? Sometimes I ask people to recall the happiest moments of their life. You know, we've all had sort of some really, sometimes you call them like spiritual experiences, like openings. That you're sitting there somewhere in the world. It doesn't have to be just the scenically sort of jaw-dropping. It was just, it's good enough. Peaceful place, maybe alone or maybe with people, and you have this feeling there's nowhere else in the whole world I'd rather be in this moment than right here with these people. Yeah, you know, it could be better. I could be a billionaire. I could have no problems. I could have really good health. But this is good enough for me. Just you've had feelings like that times. Right now, there's nowhere else in the whole world I'd rather be. Right here, right now. With these people at this time. Beautiful moments of contentment. You find the secret of happiness is just right in front of you. When you want for nothing, peaceful, content, fulfilled, at the end of a journey, and you're there. So that gives you an idea of what the mind, when it gets empowered, so happy, who wants anything else? And that means no craving, no wanting, no first hindrance, no ill will. Don't want anything. This is more than good enough. And the other part where this comes from is, again, not judging. If you start judging, well, you know, it could be better. Now, this meditation retreat, we could have room service. And now these days, you know, you've got home delivery. If you don't like the food, you can go and see Bianca, what's on the menu today? Now, I don't fancy that. So just email the local restaurant and just order what you want. And it comes delivered by one of these drones, by Amazon or whatever. To your courtesy. We could have room service. That's a good idea, isn't it? Room service. And we could also have, what else could we have? We could have state-of-the-art meditation cushions. These cushions are just so last century. You know, everything else is, you know, high-tech. You know, the iPads, iPhones. Why don't we have iZafus? What's an eye meditation cushion like a Zafu? So easy to understand. You get your remote control. With it, you know, when you come in here, get your remote control on your chair. And if it's, you know, too flat, you press a button and it moves it up. If, you know, your knees are a little bit sore, another one, and it pushes this one up over here. If you're too cold, you know, you can warm it up. I've been on these toilets they have in Korea and Japan, and they warm up. Incredible ones. You've been in those ones? Yeah. You know, I don't have much fun as a monk, but when I went over to Japan the first time, I found these toilets, and I was sitting on there for about half an hour pressing all the buttons. I confess that, that's true. I've never seen that before. No, you get off the toilet, you press and see how far the water goes. Have you done that? Yeah, you probably have. So anyway. So you should have something like that. Maybe, you know, it's not just press water, but you know, if you feel like sloth and torpor, press a button. Coffee. Latte, flat white, with soy milk or with cow milk or low-fat milk or you have Colombian roast, you have Brazil, whatever. You press all your buttons and then it comes out. You know, just you don't have to go all the way over there to the kitchen to get something. You just press the buttons and then you get your cup. And then off into jhanas. And I could also have a control. I've fantasized about this time. I could also have a control on your seats. So anyone who just, you know, gets a bit sleepy, I just give you only a couple of volts. Out of compassion. Meditation cushion. So anyway, your own air conditioner, so you know, it comes up here in a nice little air conditioner to just make you nice and cool or hot if it's a bit too cold. So anyway, all those little fantasies and ideas. You can always make it better, can't you? But that's not the point. The point is, this is good enough. You're so content. I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world, just right here, right now. And then you get this incredible peace. It's called a taste of freedom. Because what it is, the insights, I'll do more deep insights tomorrow, the two types of freedom. We always think there's only one type of freedom, and that's the freedom to get what we want when we want it. It's called the freedom of desire. So you only want something, you get it. That is like what many people think heaven is. When you want something, you just get it. Like room service, instant. But that's no freedom at all. The other type of freedom which you find in deep meditation is the freedom from desire. You don't want anything. You're happy being here. Don't want anything else in the whole world. Just to be here. So much joy. Nothing out there, it's just coming from inside. Contentment, making peace with things. So joyful. Don't want anything in the whole world. Just to be here with my stupid brain, my tired mind, and my unteachable disciples. So I'm just happy to be here. Now you can see that is the path to freedom. The freedom from desire. Just peaceful, and the energy, because you're happy to be here, you don't want anything, you don't waste your energy. It's not static. Stillness is not static. Stillness increases. Because it's stillness, it grows in power. The energy keeps coming and coming and coming, and you get really high. All the energy goes into knowing. You wake up, and you're just blissing out, and you can just let go of stuff. The body has done its job. You just with the beautiful limiters, oh, they get really incredible, powerful, but you don't want anything. If you want anything, you take away its energy. It's like unplugging the source of the energy. You just keep it plugged in there to doing nothing, and it builds and builds and builds. Incredible limiters, jhanas, the whole works. You don't do anything. You don't want anything. It just happens when you don't want anything. Which is finishing off with today's talk with a great quote. I'm actually going to do two quotes. The first is from the third Zen patriarch. The path is easy for those with no preferences. So if you, you know, you don't have any preferences about being a great meditator or an ordinary meditator, you don't have any preferences of what happens to you in this meditation retreat, sloth and torpor for 9 days or nimittas and jhanas with all the psychic powers, well, it's all the same. If you have no preferences, then this path is just so simple, so powerful, easy, you can't miss it. But if you want something, I don't want this, I want something else, then you're going to just suffer. And that also connects with Sudhimagga, one of my favourite sort of little poems, and that is that the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. No traveller, no doer on it is seen. If you're doing the path, if you're walking the path, if you're travelling the path, if you, you are doing something, the path vanishes. But if you vanish first, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Then the path is just so simple, so wide, you can't miss it. So you disappear. That is why I said the other day, Ajahn Brahm can't enter jhanas. I've been a monk for such a long time, I wrote all about jhanas, but I can't do it. The path is, but Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. The sense of self, the traveller, the doer, the one who is trying to get somewhere, that has to vanish. The more that vanishes, the more that disappears, the more the path becomes unmissable. You just go for it. You just have got no choice. It's nothing to do with you. You vanish. You're gone, baby. You're gone. I was stuck in the 60s. So this is where we understand how the hindrances are overcome. All come from a sense of I wanting to get somewhere. Little by little that vanishes. You don't do anything, you just be. Just be aware. Don't try and judge where you are, what you're supposed to do next. Just be. Content to be in this moment, happy to be here. This is good enough. And when you really do that, because your doer, your will, disappears, so do you. That is why it's scary. Because you vanish. It's much better with you. You vanish when you get out of here. Ajahn Brahm's a pain in the butt. As soon as I let him disappear, ooh, this is nice. So this is about how to overcome the five hindrances. So I've gone over time again. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Crazy monk. Okie dokie. So there are some interviews for those who are crazy enough to want interviews. And I'm crazy enough to be there for you. Okay, that's another thing I'm not saying. Okay, so have a nice morning. You don't have to have a nice morning. I'm not a control freak. If you want to have a miserable morning, you have my full permission to have a miserable morning. It's totally up.